Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
You see, now I possess the one Darwinian advantage that humans have over other animals. The ability to BS my way through anything.
The greatest!
How about that guy for my beat?
Yeah, Jesus. That was like getting a little like uncomfortable for me.
Was it getting? Yeah. Did you feel like a voyeur? Like a...
I felt like I needed to put a quarter in. You know?
to keep reading the thread, you have to insert a quarter. Like...
Dave every once in a while gets emails praising his beats, wanting to Dave to send him his beats, and there was just one, and I happen to be CC'd on all of these, of just like, it was like a relationship. It was like you guys kind of progressively got closer and closer, like the emails got more sexual.
He was a wonderful man.
At first it was like you just met and then you're like sharing a milkshake with two straws, you know.
Eating a piece of spaghetti until we meet in the middle.
And then the last one, when I finally had to like ask to be removed, it was like the hot Carl.
I don't know what that means. He was nice.
When Mr. Garrison is teaching kindergartners sexual positions.
Remember when we had that discussion on sex education? Is that the sort of thing that you would be in favor of? Like that kind, that pedagogical style?
He shows the kindergartners how to put a condom on and he puts it on with his mouth.
Is that the one where the kids just start wearing condoms because he said that if you don't, you might get AIDS?
Well, no, Ms., the teacher, the other teacher.
Are you already drunk? I better start catching up.
Yeah, well, I guess we've started the podcast. So today we're going to talk about, I don't know what the theme is, being trapped in a perspective. And all right, this is a bad sign.
You know how in movies they like have these little cues, like when someone's driving and there are all these warning signs. Like I have all of these warning signs popping up in my mind about like how badly this is going to go, because we're recording at night. We haven't recorded at night in a while. Night episodes tend to share some qualities with each other. Let me give it a shot though. So because this is our ongoing series on where we pick a paper. And the central paper that you picked, we'll probably talk about other stuff, is by, does he go by Bernard,
like the fucking man.
Bernard Williams. Bernard Williams.
He's the best. I love
him. And it's an essay in, although, you know, I was talking to philosophers, a lot of people hate him.
I know.
An essay in one of his books called Rawls and Pascal's Wager. I think the theme is, when you unwittingly stack the deck in favor of your own position such that you are too ignorant to see that you are not making any progress. You've not actually opened your mind.
There's two steps. There's one in which like you want to take a step out of your own perspective and develop a form of inquiry or a way of establishing certain principles that wouldn't just apply to people who have or share your perspective, but they would apply to everybody, to all, like all human beings. But then you end up in the method of trying to do that, you end up importing certain values and core principles that you have that are part of your perspective. And so you end up with principles that support your own specific point of view. And I think this happens in so many different domains, in science, in ethics, right, in politics, in...
Yeah, and it might, and I think that there are different ways in which this happens across these different disciplines, but like the core theme is we think that we're coming up with ways to justify or defend or arrive at a position, and what we don't realize is that we've baked in our assumptions.
Baked in.
Like they're already they've come preloaded. You think that you are being as objective and, you know, as possible. So yes, that's the theme. But before we talk about that paper.
Yeah, so I had this idea of, and I have to give credit to Bobby Sue, who is a former graduate student, now working in the office in philosophy, right? We've been like passing along recommendations of things. I recommended Mr. Robot to her, which she loved. We were talking about movies, and I was my new thing that I'm really riled up about and enthusiastic about and love is Frank. And so I recommended that. And I asked her if she had any recommendations. She said, I don't know. Not, she said, although I will say this, like I have a litmus test. I'm not going to be able to go out with this person. I'm not going to be able to date this person. I'm not going to be able to be good friends with this person if they don't like Drive, was her example. I thought that was a, like, you know, I really love Drive. Do you like Drive?
I do. Yeah. I really do.
Great movie.
It's so much better than his follow-up movie,
Only God Forgives. Did you see that? Yeah. Anyway, so, and I thought that was a good example of, because it's not obviously one that is your favorite movie of all time or that, but it does sort of pick out something about a person if they don't like the movie. You know what I mean? And so that's when I thought, well, we should talk about this. What's the movie that if the person you're going to spend the rest of your life with doesn't like it, then they're not that person.
Then they're not that person. So I gotta say I can't feel that strongly about it, because I've definitely dated people who didn't like things that were near and dear to me.
Well, that's why you have to pick carefully.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be a deal. I don't think there's anything that would be a deal breaker. I would just be so disappointed, and then I would have to never talk about it.
Oh, so mine are much stronger. Like I have a few here that if they don't like it, it's not going to work out. Like they'll make some other man very happy, maybe, or not, I don't know, but not me. Like we're just have, it was nice knowing you.
So you feel that strongly about the Titanic, huh?
Yeah. the scene where he's painting her is just,
I like that one that always shows up in the top 10 on YouPorn. Like for the year, not for the month,
if
but for the year.
Like that. Like.
I'm gonna ask for permission to expand the question to not just movies.
I'm down with that.
Okay.
I have a few other things too. Okay. All right. You want me to start, or you want to start?
Yeah. You start.
All right.
I'm David Pizarro from Cornell University.
I'm weirdly excited.
Okay.
All right, so Drive is a really interesting one, and I think it would be weird if the person I liked didn't like Drive, but it's not something that would rule it out entirely, so I'm not going to say Drive.
That's an interesting one, because I can see that if there were a woman who liked men and she liked Drive and he didn't, it's saying something different than, you know, it's a pretty violent movie, and not that women don't like violent movies, but like, you know, there are stereotypes. Men are like, if we
it's
just look at box
violent.
Office,
there's really one really violent scene.
Yeah, it's viscerally violent. It's like one of those where the Foley artists use melon to great effect.
Yeah. Just the, like, it just takes, you know, that first scene, which is just such a masterpiece of filmmaking.
So tense.
Into the credit sequence, which is awesome, with that like kind of 80s neon.
Just, I love that. Yeah.
Like if at that point you're not on board, it's conceivable. It's conceivable that I would still want to spend the rest of my life with you, but it's yeah. it's like conceivable, like zombies, you know, like barely, like not metaphysically possible, but it's like logically possible or something. I'm giving you a night call to tell you how I feel. I want to drive you through the night, down the hills. I gotta tell you something you don't want to hear. I'm gonna show you where it's dark, but have no fear. There's something inside you. It's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy, but you're still the same. I would give someone a break in that it's slow. It's like you got to get into it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is a masterpiece. And I'll point people again to this blog that I always bring up, Tony Zhu's Every Frame a Painting, where he analyzes the shots in Drive. And it's just even more brilliant than you think it is. But okay.
All right. I have some other ones, though. Again, In Bruges was also in that category, like barely conceivable, but now we're into not possible. Like, it's not going to work out if they don't, like, the documentary Spellbound.
The Spelling Bee.
Yeah. If you don't like that, it's, you know.
You're a monster.
No hard feelings. Yeah, maybe hard feelings.
By the way, is this just for romantic partners, or do you think that this would matter for, like, best friends?
I'm going to keep it to romantic partners, but if it wouldn't apply to best friends, then I want an argument as to why not, like, you know,
right.
But I've been thinking about it that way. All right. Then it gets harder for me. Goodfellas. I mean, obviously if they don't like Goodfellas or something like that, then it's not going to work out, but that's doesn't like everybody likes Goodfellas.
Yeah, so there's a diagnosticity, right? It's less about the movies, and it's more about the information that it provides. And liking Goodfellas doesn't provide me with that much information.
Right.
Right, because so many people like think, like, oh, it's not my favorite movie. But, like, who could deny that it's, like, a brilliant movie?
Right. There are people, I'm sure, who just don't like it, who couldn't sit through it, who are like, but those aren't even people that we would be, that it would have gotten to this place where really? We're at the litmus test. And then there are movies like Groundhog Day where it's a similar kind of thing. I think that's a good one, right? Then I went back to Preston Sturges. So, like, Sullivan's Travels and Miracle of Morgan Creek.
I've never seen either of those or heard of them.
We can't be friends. We can't be romantic.
We can't be lovers.
We can't be romantic. Congratulations, Mr. Email Guy. That
you won.
Dave Speeds. You win. Sullivan's Travels is amazing, and Miracle of Morgan's Creek is like probably his best, funniest comedy. And those are just such good spirited, great, funny, well written, just entertaining movies that would be a problem.
You better be keeping track of these, because when I'm looking up this shit to put in the notes page for verybadwizards.com/84.
I have some notes on okay. that, but I didn't take notes about our main topic, but I took notes on it. Bad News Bears, you know, the 70s version.
Yeah. Was that the 70s?
Yeah. It's like 77, 76.
You were watching that in college? Sorry.
Pink Panther movies. Jackie Brown's the only Tarantino movie I would put on there. And Hustle and Flow. That's it.
Look at you trying to like pander to the urban audience.
We really only do well in rural areas.
We do. I'm interested in Jackie Brown being your favorite Tarantino.
No, I didn't say it was my favorite.
Is it the most diagnostic then?
Because Jackie Brown is is a movie that tells you a little bit more about the person, because it's not as like flashy and the, you know, everybody loves Pulp Fiction and it moves at a more languid pace, but it's probably his most like deeply felt movie, you know. And it's also just really like great performances.
Well, like Robert De Niro just getting stoned. Like, you want to fuck? Like, and just like, yeah. Just
Bridget Fonda is like, yeah, like her best performance. And like, where has she been? What happened to Bridget?
I don't know what happened to Bridget.
She's awesome in it. And Pam Grier is so good. And Robert Forrester.
Robert Forrester is brilliant. If it's diagnostic, I'm curious what it's. What feature of your romantic partner this is capturing? Is it like that they're willing to appreciate character development? Like,
it shows that they can appreciate a kind of slow pace and a kind of groove in a movie, and they don't need it to, you know, Goodfellas is a better movie, but it's also easier to watch. It's like pulling right. you in at every moment. I like the idea of it being diagnostic.
Yeah, and I think that what you're capturing is some form of patience, like that where you're open enough to like to let things. Because I gotta say, the first time I watched Jackie Brown coming out of Pulp Fiction, which was and still continues to be my favorite movie probably of all time, I was disappointed the first time, and it took repeated viewings of it in order to really appreciate Chris Tucker in the trunk of a car. so it's tracking some sort of patience and willingness to like sit. Same with Drive, right? Drive has long, slow shots that like modern movies tend to not have. Like, so it's
and
like
long,
not,
like silent scenes where nobody's speaking. That I agree. That's another diagnostic movie that it's for similar reasons. Some movies don't wear their greatness on their sleeve, and you need repeated viewings before you really appreciate them. But then those are also the kinds of movies that you can watch again and again. Like I've probably watched Drive like 8 times, Jackie Brown more than any other Tarantino movie, because it's just so rewatchable.
Yeah,
and Pulp Fiction is I would say it's probably better, but like you get a little sick of it, and you need to give it like a few years before you see it again.
Well, one of the problems with Pulp Fiction is there were so many like imitations of the style and like poor imitations that it actually they seem like tropes, even though that was the first time that they were done.
Which sucks, which is totally unfair.
totally unfair. Okay.
All right. So what else do you have?
So there's diagnostic in the sense that like not everybody might like it, but it says something about the person. But there is diagnostic also in that a lot of people like it. And if you don't like it, there's something that I don't like about you. And the one movie that stands out to me that I can't imagine somebody wouldn't just... It's sort of like Groundhog Day, where if it's on TV, you watch it. It's almost like an entailment. If it is on TV, I will watch it. And that movie for me is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. There is no time in which Ferris Bueller's Day Off is on TV that I don't enjoy watching it. It like, yeah, you clearly don't agree with me.
No, I mean, I like it. I'm not sure if that's the one that I would pick.
Suppose it came on and you're sitting next to somebody you care about and they're like, ugh. I'd be like, wait, what? Like, it's annoying. I'd be like, you're annoying. And then I'd just storm out of the room.
Slam the door. David, what's wrong? Nothing.
Leave me alone. They try to make the mileage go backwards. How is that not good?
I'll tell you who the thing that spoils the movie a little bit for me is Ferris Bueller's girlfriend is really not good.
I like her. I like that sort of. You know what I like about her is how she opened up to what's his face?
Cameron. Cameron?
Yeah, Cameron. Yeah. There's a point at which she like really brings him out of his shell. And like at that point, you think that she's just like some like stuck up like hot girl in high school. The whole his room, I just wanted his room, like with that synthesizer, where he had the little pulley rope that made it sound like he was snoring. I was like, that is fucking badass. Like, that is...
I have no issue with it. But I could also, like, see myself leading a very happy life with somebody that... It just, it's not that they hate it. Like, if you hated it, it was weird. But it's like, eh. You know, if they were like, yeah, eh, it's kind of funny. Their comedies are better today.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, I'll put Ferris Bueller over Hustle and Flow any day.
Like, I think that.
I don't know. I'm not sure what you were saying with the Hustle and Flow. Pulp Fiction might be on there for me. Like, I can't envision that somebody doesn't appreciate the perfection that is Pulp Fiction.
Books? I just have one book.
Go for it. I'm thinking about
A Confederacy of Dunces.
Never read it.
Oh my God.
I mean I supported the Union Army. I don't know.
No. Confederacy of Dunces. By the way, cities, New Orleans. If you don't like New Orleans, then it's definitely not going to work out.
But by New Orleans, I hope you don't mean like the shitty touristy French Quarter where they're drawing you into like they're begging you to come into their bars.
Yeah. Oh, I lived there for a year, remember?
Yeah. There's a litmus test for humor, the sort of humor that I like, which it's not that I wouldn't be with someone, it's that I would respect them less. This is not just true of romantic partners, but like also of friends. The Far Side. Like, if there is not at least one Far Side cartoon, then then our humor is very different. Like, and I don't know that we could laugh at the same things.
Like, yeah,
it's super diagnostic of a certain kind of a little. Do you know the comic, the web comic XKCD?
No.
Yeah, that's another one. I mean, it's a little bit nerdier, but there's just a particular kind of weird humor, like particular kind of random humor that is in those you show them to some people. It's like an amazing litmus that you show something that you think is hilarious to some people, and they just, it's not that they think, well, that was, I get how that's funny, but I didn't laugh that much. It's that they just don't get it. They're just like, I don't know why anybody would think that's funny.
So are you just trying to like say like really mainstream late 80s stuff and just to balance my like hipster artsy thing, or like,
well, XKCD is still going on.
Like Seinfeld, is that going to be your next one? And
no, although
Friends,
it's just your. No, this is going to be the awkwardness that came up in our humor episode, where you just like mainstream shock comics, like, and I like the subtle
mainstream, like the wit
of like the singular panel with, right, like the two fish. This is a random example. Like,
I agree with you about Far Side. I mean, it would be weird, but I don't know anybody that doesn't at least like the Far Side. Like, do you know anybody?
Oh yeah, man. Like, some people just don't get any of the Far Side. Like, they would never bother to read it. They just think that it's like weird and just like that. Just a random comic of like. Like, there's two little fish in bed and a mom fish, and the one fish says, "Mom, Theron's dried the bed again." But like, some people would look at it and they'd be like, "That's just stupid."
Well, yeah, but you're not. Well, you don't look, associate you with those people. Who are those people?
I didn't judge your fucking like.
Well, no, I specifically chose ones that like somebody could possibly
but
not like.
Obviously, I'm choosing ones that people don't like. Like, you don't have to believe me, but we also were raised in a very different environment. You with
That's
your
true.
Elite East
That's
Coast,
true.
Like, educated.
I'm
like,
not proud of it.
Your travails that led you to be at Penn.
That was when you could still go to Penn and not come from a rich family. TV? Do you have any TV?
Besides Seinfeld.
So Key and Peele, if they don't like Key and
Peele.
Oh,
yeah. Key and Peele. Like, Dave Chappelle. And Key and Peele, that's the kind of humor that I think is just
British Office.
British
probably.
Office. That, yeah. There is that kind of awkwardness in the British Office that I think is diagnostic. If you can, some people just cannot deal with the awkwardness of the British right. Office. And I think that is a trait that I would appreciate.
And if they're gonna be with you, they're gonna, you know, have some awkward moments.
Oh, so many awkward moments.
So they need to be prepared.
Practice their eye rolling. Like distancing themselves in public from, I
guess. Deadwood is a little more diagnostic, Can you think of being with somebody that doesn't like Deadwood?
No, and I got to say that I was, when I started watching Deadwood, I had already watched it, I think, twice with my girlfriend, and she got really into it. It was like, oh, good, because this might actually work. Yeah, I was like a little, I was a little worried. I was like, you know, I was still at the time where I was trying to pick up what she would be sensitive to and what not. And I don't, just in case you're thinking, I don't hold other people to the standards of Star Trek fandom that I have.
That's good.
In fact, it might be a bad thing.
Is there anything that if they liked? The only thing I can think of off the top of my head that would be disqualifying if they liked is the movie Crash.
First not of the all, Cronenberg. There's two.
Yeah, not the Cronenberg, the other one, the Best Picture winner.
Yeah, the Best Picture one. Why? Because it's just like
it's so patently
heartstring pulling.
Not just it's one of the most poorly written, just
you're so
unsubtle. There's no nuance.
If it wins Best Picture,
every
it's
character
just
is a certain way. The way it works is if you're racist, like you wake up in the morning and you just say racist things until you go to sleep, and that's how it works. But then you have one moment of like non-racism. And then if you're not racist, you never have a racist thought. You get like perfect scores on the implicit association test. But then like you shoot a black guy at one point. Everybody is all one way except for one moment in their life.
That's
what passes for complexity and nuance.
The kinds of movies I hate are things, Dangerous Minds, and that Sandra Bullock, like the white woman steps in to save like some black kids. Like
Sandra Bullock steps in.
Yeah.
Or Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah. Or Michelle Pfeiffer like turns the chair backwards to talk to Coolio.
How do I reach these kids?
There's one exception, which is a brilliant movie that Finding Forrester.
Oh, yeah.
With Sean Connery and...
So I'm not throwing this in, but because I'm not even 100% sure that I love the movie, but Frank was really good, and I think it's a movie that our audience would like.
Yeah.
And they may not have seen.
Yeah, I mean, the texts that you were sending me after you watched Frank were like, I was there, is he about to come, or did he just... Like, it was like, they were more like the about to come.
about to, yeah.
Yeah.
I got... especially excited about, I tried to commit you to doing a podcast on it.
I was like, well, let me watch it first. Let's take it easy. Take it a step at a time.
And then you didn't text me back for like 3 days. And I thought, oh God, he saw it. He saw it with Alex.
I know you were all, like you were super sensitive about it.
I know. But I stand by it. Part of it is that I think it has just a fantastic ending. It's just the ending that made me cry like a baby. It's like really moving and sweet, but also funny, and then a lot of interesting.
I'm convinced that they're like upon reflection, I got to watch it one more time. But I think we'll probably end up talking about it. There's finally like a certain class of movie that I don't think that somebody needs to like, but they need to put up with it with me, and not hate it. Because if they hated this kind of movie, then I would just feel bad and my overall utility would go down and in life. And those are, I'm going to lump together samurai movies, kung fu movies, and spaghetti westerns.
Yeah.
Like the kind, because everybody likes like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, fine. Like everyone likes Kurosawa or whatever. But I'm talking about the kind that come on.
Like hard boiled.
Like on a Sunday afternoon where like
the killer,
like poorly dubbed, like those are just good. Like I love them. Like
Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah. Those spaghetti westerns where they do this ADR thing where like it's their voices, but they're still not synced up to the because they all went into the studio and re-recorded their lines. So it's kind of like off.
Well, some of them were Italian. Like it's dubbed. Yeah, a lot of them were Italian doing.
Yeah, but even the English actors are dubbing their own lines. Yeah. It's the weirdest effect.
And I remember I got the DVD and thought it was broken, and I was really pissed. And so then I got like another DVD of it, and then I realized, oh, that's just how it is. But I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we should take a
break. Let's take a break.
When was it God made people? Was it the sixth day? He should have stopped on the fifth.
I need to put more batteries in this too. So let me.
Is that a euphemism for doing a line of cocaine? I was gonna say when you asked like what would hate if they were it was their favorite movie, and like shit like Beauty and the Beast. Like I hate musicals, let alone like cartoons.
How are you not gonna like Beauty and the Beast?
Because it's a fucking musical. It's like and Angela Lansbury is a teapot. The Lion King.
Fuck the Lion King, but Beauty and the Beast is a great movie.
All of those, Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, are all the same. Little Mermaid.
You don't like a strong heroine, is what it is. You want your princesses to be docile. And,
I don't want princesses. I don't. I want real women.
I want to see bestiality in my fairy tales.
That's true. Probably ruined a generation of kids who now think it's okay to like fuck a werewolf or whatever.
No, it didn't ruin them and enlighten them. Oh, What We Do in the Shadows is one that it would be tough for me to.
That's like Bella's favorite movie.
Isn't it? It's so awesome.
I think we drink virgin blood because it sounds cool.
I think of it like this. If you were going to eat a sandwich, you would just enjoy it more if you knew no one had fucked it.
I love that structure of joke. This is the time where we take a moment to thank you guys all for your support, for the emails and the reviews, the donations, and the Amazon click-throughs. If you are interested in giving us support for the first time or continuing it, there's a number of ways you can do it. First is just communicate with us, verybadwizards@gmail.com. Tweet at verybadwizards, at Tamler, at Pease. If you want to leave us an iTunes review, that always helps.
Leave some iTunes reviews. I think that does help and will get us, boost us up a little on the charts.
Yeah, we've been like sort of staticky. It really doesn't. There's no rhyme or reason. If you want more tangible support, go to our support page, verybadwizards.com/support, and there you can click on the Amazon link and just shop as you would normally on Amazon. You don't pay any more, but we get a little chunk of change. Or you can donate to us directly via PayPal, and we really, really appreciate all of the people who have done all of those things.
So the other thing is I think you asked for volunteers to send possible t-shirt designs.
Oh yeah,
and we might have a winner.
And we got a great one. That was we received a great design. People really seem to like it, so we're gonna try, I think, to incorporate it into our next t-shirt. But that doesn't mean we're not open to different designs. I actually really want a mug on this. So the design by Nelson Walkham, thank you, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, has our little chimp and our favorite review of all time, one star, repugnant.
Repugnant.
I gotta say, I was like a little hurt when I first read it. You know, I'm like sensitive, but now I'm just like, it's like I'm so proud of it.
That review is like, we've gotten more mileage out of that review than pretty much anything else besides porn, anti-Semitism, and like Conti.
When life gives you lemons.
Just make lemonade. We made like lemonades, like spiked with.
We made like Mike's. Yeah. Mike's.
Mike's heart. That would be a funny thing that like some douchey guy could say in a movie. I mean, I don't just make lemonade. I make Mike's hard
hard lemonade. So you want to introduce the topic?
All right, so. Part of me feels like I might have dropped the ball, at least in one sense. We had been selecting classic essays. I selected Isaiah Berlin's Two Concepts of Liberty. You selected a paper which was actually like exactly what I think this thing should be all about. It's a paper that is, it's kind of a masterpiece, but that very few people have heard of. I talked to a colleague today who listens to our podcast, and he said, "How have I never heard of that paper?"
Yeah, it's weird.
So that was a great selection. And then I wanted to, sort of on this theme of the totalitarian ego, you know, and like trapping us in our own sort of perspective, our prism of values and biases, I wanted something. And, you know, he mentions science and how there is parallels to this in science, how, you know, the theory laden observation is and how tempting it is to ask questions in a way that will get your desired result. So I was looking for something by Thomas Kuhn or something where, you know, that plays on that theme of how it is in the sciences. And then I thought, really what I'm interested in is a kind of a broader point. And it's like almost like Nietzschean perspectivism idea or a kind of Marxist idea.
Is that a real word?
Perspectivism. Yeah, it is. It's not a great word.
I'm an internalist about perspectivalism.
That probably is a position.
And to be fair, it's not like we weren't going to read The Structure of the Scientific Revolution.
Right, we weren't. I do feel like there's something like by like Helen Longino or something like that on feminist philosophy of science. I ended up just sort of choosing a really short essay by Bernard Williams, who I love.
This is like the longest apology you've ever given.
I know, and I haven't even really talked about what the topic is.
You're like, listen, it's not big. It probably won't make you feel good, but thank you for having sex with me in advance anyway.
It's not going to be as hard as you want it to be. Okay. The essay I picked is more about like a topic. A short essay by Bernard Williams on Pascal's wager and Rawls. And Rawls's original position, thought experiment.
Which I believe is missionary.
John Rawls, yes.
No, the original position.
I would also think that was John Rawls's favorite position. Like, that's the position that you would choose under the veil of ignorance.
You didn't know who you were going to be.
Right, exactly. It's like the Maximin approach to sex.
Be under the veil of ignorance, doggy style is the position.
Reverse cowgirl.
This episode is going to be so difficult to edit.
So
it's
the
subset of the general argument.
It's an example. Yeah, it's a subset of it. It's these two steps. It's like, yes, we recognize that we have values and we recognize that we have certain core moral beliefs, but we're going to develop a method to take us out of that and just come up with the rational way of judging which moral system is the best. So first there's that urge to step back. The step one is the urge to step back and get outside of your perspective and try to take the view from nowhere or the view from everywhere.
Right.
And then there is the second step, which is what Bernard Williams accuses Rawls especially, but also Pascal of doing, is sort of smuggling in or baking in, as you said in the opening segment, certain assumptions that are part of your perspective, part of your worldview. And then the result is going to be something that coincidentally enough sort of supports your original beliefs and value system. So with Rawls, it was sort of a kind of liberal Kantian individualism that he starts out trying to defend, but then the accusation is that he imports some of those assumptions into the process of getting them back again.
So the first thing I thought is that this essay scratches all of your itches, right? It's in line. And in fact, when we talked about thought experiments, we talked a lot about the original position, and I can see now how this essay probably influenced you.
I read it like 3 weeks ago for the first time,
which is that there, like, it's a fool's errand to to decontextualize and sort of by process of subtraction, the sheer will of subtracting your own biases, which is consistent with a totalitarian ego, like, and all of the work on how hard it is to de-bias yourself, like, it's nigh impossible to ask that people strip themselves. And it's interesting that Rawls asks people to strip themselves of almost everything other than, like, except for the faculty of reason that he thinks is the very one that's going to lead to the right answer. It's, again, very important that that's the step he asks you to take. He doesn't ask you to strip yourself of all reason and just keep your desire. Right.
He wants to turn it into decision theory. So I guess we should maybe explain for Rawls what we're talking about. So Rawls's original position famously is trying to establish principles of justice. So the idea is you're in this hypothetical position of choice where you are self-interested. You're trying to come up with the best principles that will, you know, further your own interests. The problem is you don't know anything about yourself. You don't know what kind of talents you'll have, whether you'll be born into a good family or a bad family, whether you'll be smart or dumb,
ugly or good looking. You're going to be randomly assigned to one of many conditions, and those conditions are just various statuses in society and everything.
And you don't know, like, that one of the interesting parts of it is you don't even know your conception of the good. So you don't even know what your values are. You don't know whether you'll love family, you know, you'll value family above all else, or religion, some sort of religion above all else. You just don't, you have no idea, like, what are the things that give meaning to your life.
You're not yet a Republican or a Democrat.
You haven't yet felt the burn.
And so this thought experiment, that's the first step. It's a method. It's supposed to be, here's a method at arriving what would be a just society.
So the rational part is, like, you do what's in your self-interest, but the fair part is that you don't get to start from unequal ground. Like, everybody's at the same place in the original position because of the veil of ignorance. And so whatever people would agree to is going to be the fair and just principles. And Rawls's idea was, well, since we don't know what our conception of the good is, we're going to need these primary goods like rights, liberty, individual liberty, and have our rights respected, and some degree of wealth, and a kind of respect. I mean, literally all Kantian things. That's what he. This is one of the things that Williams criticizes him for, is the primary goods, and the way he orders the primary goods are exactly what, like, a Kantian Western individualist would think are the things that matter most. But those things are supposed to be the things that are just prerequisites for you getting the goods that you might want out of life.
Right.
And that's why you're going to start out at a baseline of, I need these primary goods so that I can pursue whatever it is that I want out of life and I find meaning in life from.
Right. So the way I always imagine this is like a literal huge veil and a bunch of free-floating spirits, like, behind it, wondering what status in life they'll be randomly assigned to, and having to, like, sort of vote for the structure of society that will ensure that they will not get fucked over. And so somebody is going to be the worst off. So what they're voting on essentially is, how bad should the worst off person be, right? And so this is the...
Well, no, they're not. That's already, like, taking in the difference principle, like, putting that in. I mean, you're begging the question if you say they're trying to make sure that they don't get fucked over. That doesn't have to... That's not necessarily the rational goal. It could be that they want to roll the dice. They just want to do whatever is the most rational thing to do to further their own interests.
Yeah. So I should say, but Rawl seems to think that what that pursuing your rational self-interest entails is right. that you will want a society in which you can at least guarantee that you won't be below a certain level of.
And what he ends up producing are these principles that allow inequality, but only if it benefits the least advantaged. And right. that sort of assumes a lot. Why would you necessarily do that? Why wouldn't you go for utilitarianism, where you'll just have the best chance of leading the life with the most net utility? And the reason is he thinks that it's rational to be risk averse in this situation. That right. like up to a certain level of primary goods, you really need to have that. And then everything, and it gets like once you get past that, it's like diminishing returns. And right.
and this is actually in our previous discussion, this was one of the things that you pointed to that I hadn't really thought of, because I guess I am risk averse. And so if I were distributing resources in this fictional world, you said like, well, fuck it, I'm willing to take the gamble. Like if you could be if I could be butt rich, like, and there's a risk that I will be like really in misery, like, let's roll the dice, motherfucker. Like, yeah. let's do it. And that's not necessarily irrational. Like, I mean, it's not even close to necessarily irrational. It is simply a value that you might hold, or a propensity that you might hold. And just because he's asked you to like remove various psychological aspects of yourself, he's still assuming that you are retaining this psychological aspect that is not a feature of rationality. It is a feature of an just individual difference.
Of his, right. of him being a bit of a pussy.
Right. And so you might say, well, no, you ought to care about the worst off, but that's not the method that he's proposing.
Right.
Right. He's not like, it's tempting to say, well, yeah, he's right because the conclusion is right that we should care about the worst off. But that's not what the method is saying. The method is saying that will be concluded if you just start off as purely self-interested behind the veil of ignorance.
So that's right. And there's a kind of complication that Williams brings up that I hadn't really known about or thought about, which is that there are also principles that once you're out in society, everyone will recognize as just. And will not want to change. There's no backsies in
right, exactly.
And so,
yeah, no, that's a great way of putting it.
but as Williams points out, like, well, how does he know there's not going to be any backsies? It's not going to be because people say, oh, well, this is what I would have chosen in the original position. They're going to have to recognize it as just, and the structure of the system is going to have to be such that it's stable, and that the people who are, say, dealt the best initial hand and end up having to give a good size of their income to the least advantaged, they're going to have to, the system is going to be, have to be such that that's what they are still willing to do.
Right. Like now that they're real humans, now that they're like little yeah. ghostly bodies have been like, but like incorporated and the veil has been opened, they will by necessity, according to Rawls, agree that this was the just thing, way to do things.
So there's that as a problem, is like, well, why would you necessarily pick that? And you know, people have used the original position. It's a very it's a very powerful methodology, because it seems like it's both kind of fits our sense of prudential reasoning, you know, practical reasoning, but also with this fairness that the veil of ignorance provide. So people have used it to try to justify theories of punishment, like retributivism. This is what you would choose. This is the institution of punishment that you would choose in the original position, because it allows you to have control over your own fate. There are assumptions that are baked into this thought experiment. And one of them that I think is pretty interesting that doesn't. So people, the risk averse thing obviously is not something that I came up with. It's something that people have criticized him about in the past. Also, wondering whether you have enough, if all your values are stripped for you, do you have enough to even make any decisions in the original
right,
position?
Right.
That's another
question. If this is a decision theoretic task, it seems weird for decisions to be made in the absence of all this stuff.
But the, but, yeah. but here's the one that I think is most interesting in some ways. And this is from a Marxist critique from the paper Marxism and Retribution, Jeffrey Murphy, of the original position being used to justify retribution. But it can work to all of Rawls. So his conception of rationality as a kind of self-interested, egoistic choice, like maximizing an individual's self-interest, is very sort of Western and bourgeois, capitalist, free market, individualist kind of way of thinking of rationality. He doesn't get to help himself to that. The way Murphy puts it is, you know, you start out with a bourgeois conception of rationality, you're going to get a bourgeois theory of justice, a bourgeois theory of punishment, and then that society that you'll have will think this is because they're competitive and egoistic. They'll think that this is the right conception of rationality. So it's this big cycle that just sort of feeds into itself. What do you think about that?
I'm less sensitive to this style of argument because it itself assumes that if you are a Western, if you endorse the sort of view of rationality that Western philosophers have endorsed, then that is prima facie reason to doubt that you are right about rationality. And I think that that is neither here nor there. I think that
so you just think we lucked out. We got born.
Well, we may or we may not have, but it's not evidence that it's right or wrong that it came from a particular perspective. Right. Like there's a way in which you could say, well, look, there's no ground to evaluate whether or not something is rational. And then fine, like being Marxist isn't going to get you any closer to the right idea of rationality than being a Western, you know, white male philosopher.
No, that's true. But it should make you doubt that there is a single conception of rationality.
It could. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong, because there's diversity of opinion about what
it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. It doesn't disprove it, but it gives you good reasons maybe to doubt that it's universally true.
And we've had this discussion many times, but it is no evidence to me. It's neither here nor there if somebody's doesn't know math, and that knowledge of math is unequally distributed among rich, educated people.
But that's different because those people, when they are presented with math, when they're taught math, they don't have some sort of alternate system. They're like, oh yeah, that works. That's how I think about it too. Whereas if the conception of rationality may be that it's just incommensurable.
If there were evidence that people who came to the Western educational system and changed their mind about what rationality was, I don't think that you would take that as evidence that it must be right. I think you would take it as just influence, non-rational influence on their view.
That's possible. I mean, you know, I come at it from my perspective as well, which is where this whole thing gets very kind of Rortian, postmodern, confusing.
Yeah. And you flirt with postmodernism in a way that makes me squirm
hard
in my seat. Squirm in the bad way. Like there's a big diarrhea coming and that I better stop the show.
But what about religion? It's the same argument for religion. Why should you think your religion is the right religion? If you're born in, that you just happen to have been born into the religion that's the true religion. And this is the other part of the Bernard Williams essay is on Pascal's wager, which sort of assumes that it's either a Christian God or no God, or at least that if there is a God, it's probably a Christian God.
Right.
And it has the qualities of a Christian God, right? It rewards believers and with eternal heaven and punishes disbelievers with eternal hell.
Right. I mean, I get what you're saying. I do think, though, that there are, when we're using the term rationality right now, we're using it broadly. And even in the Marxist way, I'm a little uncomfortable talking about rationality in this sort of broad way. There is a sense, a very local sense of logic that is supposedly at the heart of rationality that I do think is different from religion. That I do think that people are persuaded about certain fallacies like modus ponens most.
So, I mean, I'm a little, like, it's hard for me to totally conceive of this, but why should rationality be thought of as self-interested, ends, means kind of thinking?
Well,
for the individual.
I agree that this is not necessarily the right conception of rationality. What I don't want to grant is that there is no conception of rationality that would be right universally. I just think that rationality, it's like, it's going to be limited. Like it can give us, right? Even though you rail against like consistency and stuff like that, I think there are some basics that ought to be universal to rationality. And that this is where I agree with Williams, that Rawls is baking into the notion of rationality things that actually are external to rationality, like the assumption that self-interest ought to drive. I wanted to say something about like the sort of brilliance of the, I don't know, I bet you he did it unwittingly, but of Rawls is starting with self-interest as the basic universal,
yeah,
and ending up with a liberal notion of justice.
Right.
Right. That is brilliant. That is saying like, let's take that. Everybody can agree like that self-interest should be pursued.
Fat guys with their cigars.
Right, exactly. Like those old cartoons, those political cartoons of the fat cats. Everybody agrees on that, right? Yeah, we should pursue a self-interest. Okay, like now imagine this. And then boom, you have like a society where there's like massive amounts of redistribution of wealth. And like that, I think, is the rhetorical power. Now, yeah. I agree, though, that that's hand-wavy. But I think that's why it's successful.
It's successful, yeah. It's successful in the sense that people are, yeah, like, we're still talking about it. I don't know how much influence it had, practically speaking, politically, but
yeah, it's like successful, like Taylor Swift has a successful album. Like, I'm independent of whether or not you like
it. Or are you on Kanye's? Are you on Kanye's side?
I mean, Kanye is a genius. I don't know that Taylor Swift is a genius.
I don't know. Like, everybody loves Taylor Swift. I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, I have no.
So what I was going to say is, though, that there's still these like very Western bourgeois, you know, like the Marxists still can criticize Rawls for having this very strong individualist conception of rights. And, you know, and this is the part of Marx that I really like. The thing that's somewhat offensive about it is that it has pretensions to stepping outside of the liberal worldview to then justify the liberal worldview. But really, it's just giving, to use his terminology, a transcendental sanction of the status quo, a transcendental sanction of the existing rules. And yeah, Rawls would call for more distribution of wealth.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is actually like a pretty hardcore liberal view that it's not
within the sort of Western free market democracy kind of worldview. Like it doesn't go out. It doesn't allow itself to break free of that. A strong system of individual rights. And, you know, I'm in favor of those things, but I don't pretend, or I try not to pretend, that there's some sort of rational justification for it.
Right. But I do want to say, like, I just want to, like, I think defend a little bit that if there, like, that there are universal minimal standards of what we might call rationality that you could get everybody to agree on, like, you know, some basic logic principles that, like, underlie math and reasoning and that yield truth in a reliable fashion. It's just that those,
you know, that Gödel sort of showed that you can't have
complete. How did he do it? How did he show it?
Well, I can walk you through it. The proof.
Well, you walk me through it, but you'd be doing a whole lot of using those very rules, right? Like that. I mean, without those rules that everybody agrees on, you can't get to incompleteness. Right, so it obviously is paradoxical, but I don't think I don't think Gödel's incompleteness is really what's fucking with this
particular
view. Right. So I imagine that if you could say like, oh, let's like everybody agrees on the principle of identity, right? Like if you could build a political theory from that step, then I wouldn't care if you were, you know, a Western bourgeois person or whether you were a Marxist or whatever. It's just that I don't think that there's anything that you can start with that's not already laden with those assumptions.
Right. If you start with something too minimal, then it's not going to give you the basis for any kind of decision.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think that if a Marxist started with a thought experiment that had Marxist assumptions, they would be just as wrong and we'd be
That's almost certainly true, which is why you get in this position of kind of quasi-absurdity where, and I think this is a very Williams-y thought, is don't come up with a better way of like finally achieving that transcendental position where you've shed yourself of all biases, but just get rid of that aspiration in the first place. Just accept that you are trapped within a certain perspective and that other people are trapped within that perspective with you, and work within that and stop pretending that you're doing too much more than that. That's, I think, easier said than done. And this problem, I mean, at the deepest level, the same problem percolates down to like just scientific inquiry, to which is another case where you're trying to step outside of and you know, the dream is to get pure observation, and you end up finding it difficult not to bake into your methodology something that will give you the desired results. And we get this obviously in
right. So there's this huge underestimated effect where you start with a conclusion and you don't realize that this is influencing your attempt to move from basic principles to the conclusion is already just deeply tainted by your conclusion.
Right. Like, your hypothesis, and, which is supposed to be like a hypothesis, and we'll just look at the evidence and see if it supports it.
Right. Nobody's going to say, like, you know, I believe in liberal justice, but let me come up with this thought experiment and be like, holy shit, turns out that like this is actually the wrong thing.
I thought the veil of ignorance were going to yield these Kantian liberal principles, but
it turns out.
Turns out it's like fascism. Whoa, that's weird.
We should actually mention why the Pascal's wager. So Pascal.
Oh yeah, let's talk about that, and then we'll get to the science.
Famously, you know, Pascal said, like, look, if you believe in God and there is no God, all you get is death for eternity, which you're going to get anyway.
Right.
If you don't believe in God and God exists, you're going to suffer. You're going to torment in hell forever.
Yeah.
And so,
and you will. The opportunity cost is like living in
eternal bliss. Yeah. So if we turn this into a decision theoretic problem, even Bernard Williams admits, like, that though he disagrees with this argument, he's like, at least Pascal has on his side something like infinite suffering, which is like pretty clear that you can't
right equate. I mean, there is a way in which the argument can still work if you get rid of some of his assumptions that are problematic. It might still work, just because it really is a choice between infinite bliss and infinite versus infinite suffering, or just the same.
If those assumptions held, everybody agreed, like, you know, it's probably in Pascal's time, like, there is a Christian God, and like, it's either there is a Christian God who eternally punishes or
no, but even if it's like there could be a bunch of different gods, and it still might make sense to at least pick one and pick one with the heaven and the hell.
That's true. Because not picking.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So even if you pick wrong, you pick wrong, you know, you're kind of fucked. But like, at least you're giving yourself a chance.
Pick the one that lets you drink and fuck.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's that. But it's one of the things I love about the Williams article is he clearly has more respect for Pascal's wager than for the original position, which is great. the reason that the assumptions that don't work or that are problematic that people have raised are, A, you know, he says it's like 50-50, but that's obviously not necessary for the argument, given that you have the infinite disparity of infinite pleasure or infinite pain. But also that the God that you're believing, and this is where you start baking in your assumptions, because he was a Jansenist Catholic, you know, that this God will value your belief so much, even a belief that is generated by just you playing the odds in this somewhat right. cynical.
Yeah. Yeah. That he'll be like, oh, I'm glad you chose based on this like calculation. I tend to believe that sincerity would be what one of the things that God wants.
I mean, he might, you could imagine a God that was like, no, I just wanted you to go like do the best you could based on the evidence that you had. Right. And if you really just did this as a cynical ploy, then fuck you, you're going to hell. In fact, that's what I would do if I was God.
Yeah.
It's like, no, kiss ass. You're not getting it.
I mean, that's kind of what we do in classes, right? Like what? Well, show some sincerity.
Right.
Don't just come kiss my ass so that you get a good grade.
I mean, it probably still works, but we try to not make it. you won't even take the chance.
I'm not even going to my own Pascal's wager in this case means that there's no reasonable
a possible chuckle versus getting fired.
Exactly.
Versus like a Title IX lawsuit.
But yeah, in this spirit, there is this guise of clarity in going back to basic principles that is tempting everywhere, as you point out, politics, science, even in personal, the decisions that you make in your life. One of the things that we talked about a little bit but didn't make it into the last episode was this discussion of at the social psychology and personality conference, this discussion of the moral foundations theory and the notion of purity. And the talk that I gave was essentially critiquing the notion of purity by saying the way that we measure things. So I'll make this more broad and not just about purity, because this can happen across all like the kind of psychology that I'm familiar with. If you construct a measure, like let's use a very simple example that I'm guilty of. If you use sacrificial moral dilemmas with two options, one is a consequentialist option and one is a deontological option, and then you conclude that human psychology is fundamentally built in that it reasons in one of two ways about moral stuff.
Right.
All you have done is shown that you've just reified your measures.
Right.
Right. If you created a measure that had eight things, you might conclude that the human moral mind is like divided up into eight parts and moral foundations does five or whatever. Like there is no bottom up sort of theory free way to just gather data.
Right. You've only shown that your intro to ethics teacher in college never quite got to virtue ethics.
Exactly. Exactly. In which to toot my own horn and that of my co-authors, we like character is one of the things that we've been working on. And we're just like, you know, it's amazing that it's been ignored in this recent wave of moral psychology to the extent that it has. But yeah, like if this is almost a trite point, but it's one that is so prevalent. It's so deep
point, like, cause that one, yeah, it so seems the like it might, point, like that's what moral foundations theory was supposedly criticizing is like liberal morality, which liberals assume is all of morality is just about harm. Consequentialism, right. And fairness, like, you know, rights and Kantianism, your thing. And he tried to broaden it out from that so that it includes these other factors like hierarchy and community and loyalty and purity.
Right. I think that move was a good one, right? Trying to come up with a broader, like, in fact, it was motivated by cross-cultural work by Rick Schwader and stuff like that. But I think that not to harp on moral foundations theory too much, but when we had Jesse on, we did talk about this at length. It is a
Jesse Graham.
It is clear when you look at the measure of moral foundations, right? The MFQ, the moral foundations questionnaire, So here's the sexy finding. The sexy finding is that liberals, as you just said, care about these harm and justice and fairness, and that conservatives care about these other things like purity, authority, and in-group loyalty. But when you look at the measures of what loyalty, in-group loyalty is, there's patriotism, right? There's like stuff about like the American flag, and then there's stuff about like family, I think. And those are already things that conservatives care about more than liberals. But there are plenty of issues that liberals demonstrate loyalty toward that are not in that questionnaire. But so here's what happens is you give like 10 million people this MFQ, the Moral Foundations questionnaire. You find that conservatives answer like that they're more patriotic. Right. And because that's the way you chose to measure loyalty, then you conclude that that conservatives care more about loyalty. If you had measured it another way, so this is another way in which it's baked into the theory, and in this case, the measure, you're going to find what you wanted to find, right? Yeah. And it's not really a bottom-up data-free approach. The purity dimension, which is what I was talking about, is the worst of them all because it lumps together a whole bunch of stuff. It's almost like this category of stuff that just didn't make it into the other ones. So when you look at what's measured, it is things like, I believe some things are wrong because God said they're wrong. I believe that some things are wrong because they're gross. Now, what do those two things have in common, right? Like, it's certainly the case that, like, many religious people believe that murder and rape is wrong because God said it's wrong. But those are, also, presumably, because God is telling you not to harm people. But what you end up capturing then is a whole bunch of conservative people who tend to be more religious, who agree, who endorse the statement that, you know, God matters, right. and you call them high impurity.
What about the gross part?
What's that?
What if you just did that? Would that be okay? If you just did the gross ones,
so
you just counted those.
And that was my call. I said, like, the purity dimension needs to be unpacked because there's religious. So it's even in the labels that people use. Sometimes they call them sanctity. Sometimes they call it purity. Sometimes they call it divinity. And sometimes they include metaphorical things like tainting your soul. I think all of those should be separable. And so, for instance, there should be a domain that's just about grossness. And then there should be one that's about, like, divine commands. And then there might be one that's more about, like, sort of how much you care about this metaphor of the body being, like, you know, kept clean, the soul being right. kept clean.
Purity.
And yeah, like the pure, like, don't souls. Defile your soul by doing a bad thing. And I bet you all those three things are probably tied to different psychological mechanisms. But because we lump them all, like, through, in this case, just historical, I think just weirdly historical reasons, they all get lumped together. We're actually missing out what I think are important and interesting distinctions that some people might really be motivated by the gross stuff. Some people might really care about the metaphor of their soul as being pure. And some people really care about God and what God says. And those aren't necessarily the same people or the same kinds of moral judgments.
But they end up, because he lumps them together, Height and Jesse, they end up being able to kind of support their initial hypothesis about conservatives and liberals. Is that the idea?
Yeah. And so what happens is you can get hit over the head with, like, millions of data points where you see, like, look, people who score high on purity are also conservative. And nobody really bothers to look at the items. And I'll post the items, I think, on the website. No one bothers to read the actual items that are used to measure this. And because I think if they did, they would realize that essentially what you're asking people is, are you conservative? Are you conservative? Like, twice. You're asking them twice. And that's not a real finding, right?
Conservatives, there's a high correlation between people who are conservative and people who are conservative.
Right. It's like there was a conference once that my friend told me that he went to health. It was a health psych conference that he saw a presentation showing that there was a very robust correlation between the number of beds in a hospital and the number of patients.
Finding. They didn't even have to p-hack that one,
I'm like, why wasn't that a 1.0 correlation?
Well, not everybody is in a bed, maybe. No, someone's wet the bed.
Yeah. they've tried the bed.
They've tried.
So
That's funny.
Did you like that? Now we can date. but I think, and it's not to pick on, in fact, I think that Jesse actually afterwards was really, really open to unpacking the concept of purity. I think he was pretty amenable to this criticism. But in general, I think we completely underestimate how much we are failing to see the layer of assumptions that we're using before we even go about collecting data in science. And I wanted to get to this. I know I've been rambling on, but I'll ask you this. I think I'm optimistic that science can have checks and balances so that we will, in a sort of adversarial way, that we will eventually yield truth. But I don't know that if you're that optimistic.
Well, it depends how deep you want to take this. I mean, I agree on some level with the kind of Kuhnian point that it's inescapable to that you're working within paradigms, and that the paradigms sort of provide you with ways of inquiring that will support the paradigm until one day it's broken and there'll be a new paradigm for whatever reason, but not necessarily because you have a better approximation of the truth with the new paradigm. So, but I don't even think that's more what you're saying, right? You're more saying that even if that's true, that some of these kinds of things working within normal science can be addressed. Like, you know, you give this criticism of height and Jesse, height, you know, maybe takes a break from railing about campus protests and microaggressions and trigger warnings to sort of revise the theory, or Jesse, and then it gets better. Like they're picking out more interesting distinctions.
Yeah.
And maybe you're still within this normal science paradigm, this broader normal science paradigm in social psychology at this particular moment in history, but it's definitely refining it within that.
Right.
So yeah, I agree with you on that. Like and there's a lot of room for that to happen. Like you're talking about like the moral psychology, like consequentialist, that needs, like, someone needs to break out of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
and
insane.
It's funny, even my attempts at critiquing it are doing so from inside of it.
It's not like you're this radical moral thinker. Like, you just think that there might be more to morality than consequentialism.
There is a third thing. It's the same with dual process theories. There's a website called edge.org that asks a yearly question. And one year there was a question that I ended up just not answering because I realized the answer that I wanted to give was just negative. And the question was, what scientific idea needs to be retired? And the only thing I wanted to write was the idea that there are two things. It's just so rampant. Dual process theories in psychology that posit to there's no reason that nature cared to organize things in pairs.
We're not like Noah's Ark.
Noah's Ark. And even Noah sometimes had seven so they could eat the clean animals.
You make it be as few principles as possible, even if it doesn't explain the phenomena anywhere near
as
well.
People really misunderstand parsimony as a word. Yeah, parsimony doesn't mean simple enough so that I can understand it.
And also, this happens in philosophy a lot because there's always we have this complex phenomena, why is death bad? And then you just, you have to come up with one principle.
Yeah.
So what's the, and it's just why? There's probably like 50 at least different intersecting things about why death is bad and going to be different for different people, different cultures, different times in your life. And it's like, you're the idea that, like, what's the assumption grounding that there's going to be this just one thing?
Like a singular cause. Yeah. Like, I think that psychology as a science is focused on this too. Like, we make arguments that, like, no, this thing explains this thing. I mean, people are really tempted by it. You look everywhere, like you snake oil, right? The whole premise behind snake oil is that here's this one thing that's been missing and that will cure all of these things. When, like, the reason that you're miserable and unhealthy is probably like 42 different things, like all of which include your bad sleeping habits, your poor anger management, your diet, and your...
Right. You're having unprotected sex in the parking lots. So just to bring this back full circle, I mean, I think this is part of that desire. The way of making it one principle is a way of trying to make it sort of universal and not particular. It's like, well, if there's so many different reasons and it might be different from everybody, that's unacceptable. So we have to just have that this one reason that everybody can share. And probably that's true for everybody on some level. And that allows us to get that kind of that transcendental step outward. Although it doesn't, but I think that's part of the temptation.
It is part of the temptation. And the thing is, I believe that there can be genuine discoveries about these sort of universals. So, like, there's on the one hand, say, like, the desire to find what is universal, whether it be a philosophical premise or it be a psychological mechanism. And then that temptation can actively hide, like, very interesting differences. You're losing large swaths of information that presumably would be interesting otherwise, because your assumptions are so guided by this desire.
Like all those interesting purity distinctions
that
you're losing because you lump them all together.
And it's hard. People don't like there to be, like, you know, everybody loves the, like, you know, those Paul Ekman, those pictures of the six basic emotions.
Yeah.
That's elegant. I bet you if there were seven, it just because there's not a neat row of three, three and three, people would be a little more uncomfortable, right? Like, nobody wants there to be, and nobody wants there to be nine in the US and 16 in Germany,
right?
Like, because then it would be like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know.
Two in Austria.
Two. I used to tell my kids in emotion like class that Hebrew has 16 words for guilt.
Here's a interesting thought, or not an interesting thought, but a question that I that was sort of raised by Joe Henrich when I interviewed him for the book. So is this something that's just even this need to take this transcendental step backwards to justify, to give some sort of universal rational justification, is that a local thing? Is that something that we do in the West, but that other cultures wouldn't think of doing? And his example was, like, they don't think their moral rules are binding for everybody. And if you ask them why they do it, it's like asking them why they like mashed potatoes.
Right.
It's like, I can't justify liking. If you don't like mashed potatoes, that's fine. I was reading this novel called Broken April by this Albanian writer, Ismail Kadare. And it's a really fascinating book about this these Albanian Highlanders. You know, they get involved in these blood feuds that last for generations, and, like, families are killing other families, and it's told, part of it is told from the perspective of this son in one of these families who's involved in a blood feud, and now there's a, you know, he knows that he's a target, and he's thinking, like, he thinks about other people, like, what must their lives be like? It's like kind of a sign of wonderment, like, they don't live in this thing, like, life and death is not something they take for granted. Like, they just, you know, they don't have this threat hanging over this head and these obligations and this. And he wonders sort of which one is better in one sense. Like, would I rather be in that kind of family or not? But what he never asks himself is which one is right, which one is rational, which one is like the right. He just takes it for granted that that's not how people, you know, in other parts of Albania or Europe behave or see the world, but that is how we see the world. Like, that's just taken for granted and never questioned.
Yeah. No, you know what? I actually believe that we overestimate. So we both are more motivated as Westerners to take that step, and that we underestimate how comfortable people in the rest of the world are with not taking that step. And you don't even have to go far. Like, often, you know, we often talk about, like, well, if you had to define morality, like, you know, one of the central features seems to be that it's a norm that you believe everybody ought to adhere to, right? It's not just a preference. Like, I don't just like chocolate ice cream. I think you ought to like chocolate ice cream. Right. But there are clearly cases, even like when you look at dietary restrictions, you know, amongst Jews, like observant Jews, they don't give a shit if the goy eat shrimp. Right. They think it's wrong for them to, like, and maybe wrong is the wrong word here, but it certainly has. There's certainly no reason to abandon a priori the notion that that's a moral claim just because they don't think that like non-Jews shouldn't adhere to it. Right. That, and that is one case in which, like, my assumption about what it means to make a moral claim is feeding into what I categorize as a moral claim.
As a moral claim. Yeah. Right.
I will say this, like, I think that the temptation has been a good one, because that is what science is. And so I think that science is just in a different category. Like, I think that the temptation to take...
Well, you would.
Well, I mean, we have learned, like, science is the one thing that has actually actively contributed tangible results. Like, look at this gravitational wave shit, man. It's amazing. It's like, it's fucking amazing that, like, a Swiss patent clerk scribbled some numbers on his envelope during his, like, break. And that, like, now we have, like, these extraordinarily complex machines that actually prove his theory right. Like, that science as in South Park.
Like, it puts satellites in.
And so I think the mistake is to then port over that into every other domain, right? But I think that whatever arrogance we have of thinking that we can arrive at universal truths about the empirical world, like, is a good one. It's just that the arrogance bleeds over, or maybe it started somewhere else and bled in, you know.
Well, so those are two separate questions. Like, is it good to have that arrogance, even if it is ultimately, no, it's not right. You're not actually going to be able to step outside of your scientific paradigm, but it's good to have the ambition to do that, because you're going to do better within your paradigm. Or is it that you think you actually can arrive at a kind of true greater approximations of the truth?
Yeah,
about
I think that there's the sociology part, which is it's hard for people to be convinced that old ideas were wrong. But I think, and I think this is true of every aspect of human knowledge, I think it is interesting that science falls prey to this, but I think that what gets lost in this discussion is that science is probably the least of all to get stuck in its own paradigm. That is there. That's why I think it's the structure of scientific revolution, because if you wrote a book called The Structure of Religious Revolution, you wouldn't have that much to talk about. You just have like, there's just like a, you know, there's like the Reformation and the Counter Reformation, and there's just shit that's been around since 6,000 years and nobody wants to change their mind about it. But science does actually, whether you call it ultimate, like, you know, like, let's set aside the question of realism or whatever, like, just pragmatically, like, a kid in the Congo can actually do an experiment using scientific methods that could show that, like, bourgeois Western white men were wrong. And, like, that's the beauty of the scientific method that makes me so optimistic about it. And this is the weird ironic part of like how psychology takes over, because and again, not to pick on Hyde, I think that this happens a lot. Like you make progress, and I think that like Hyde and others before him, like Schwader, Rosin, and Jesse Graham, for instance, like they have expanded our notion of morality. And but once that happens, there's the fear that you feel like you have now figured out what's right, and you entrench even more. And right. so you can kind of see this happening, where like you can start seeing people dig their heels in. They've been fighting this good fight to like tell people that they're wrong to be so narrow. And then that's causing them to dig their heels in. And before you know it, their heels are so dug in that somebody who comes in and disagrees is just leading to the same response that the other people used to have. It's super ironic that we might think of John as being entrenched in his views now.
Given that he was the one that was sort of...
Right.
You know what I liked about your speech, and I relate to, is you're starting burning bridges part of your career, which I've been like, I've been doing for the last 2 or 3 years.
I had a build
where you
thumper.
Just start like... You just start taking the thing that you used to believe in, and that people you work with and your colleagues and your friends and the people that you really like, and you just kind of trash like the very kind of core root of what they're doing.
Two things. One, I feel like you started burning bridges before you had built them.
That's true.
So you were just throwing
have to
matches
be there.
In the water and hoping it hit someone. I do find myself as I get older as like being more motivated by disagreeing with people than I was before, where I was more right. motivated by saying something new. And so I have to constantly say like, fuck, to like, it's not worth my effort to like disagree so much with people. Like, let me try to make a positive contribution, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's easier to disagree in the sense that you have something to work with and you have a paradigm to work with, even if you're criticizing the paradigm. But then if you're starting just a whole new thing that's not accepted as an appropriate framework to work with, then that's harder to do.
Yeah.
But that's like a legitimately good reason to have something like tenure. You know,
yeah.
Is that allows you to do that.
That's true. Except for that people use it as a way to allow themselves to like give speeches just dissing everybody. All right, man. So we're going to do a psychology article next time. We're going to take a break and do...
Maybe a movie episode. Paul Bloom.
Yeah. Maybe we should do a paper and a movie with Paul. We need to just milk him.
Very bad wizard.